So there were, I don't know if I had told you this in the initial.
I should add that the water rights adjudications are pitting Indians off against Mexicans, because the water rights adjudications of New Mexico, like the Amat case of the Powaki Basin or the Abeta case of the Taos Valley, really is a way of, first of all, determining the ownership and the quantity and the use of all the surface waters, as well as the groundwaters of the Rio Grande and its tributaries. But it involves this system that came in with the Americans and is predominant in the western United States of prior appropriation, which is first in time, first in rights, which means that as the ranking of the antiquity of water rights claims proceeds according to the adjudication, the oldest water rights, and therefore the most valuable water rights, are those held by the Pueblos, since they were there first. The second most senior water rights are those of the acequia systems and communities. Now, Indian water cannot be alienated, although it can be leased. And I'm sure that as the 21st century wears on, there's going to be more and more debate about who owns Indian water, the federal government or the tribes. But acequia systems, and these are individual parcientes, the federal policy has never been to acknowledge collective ownership either of land or of water rights, whereas among Spanish-speaking peoples, whereas among the tribes, the Native Americans, that was an assumed thing. That's another aspect of policy and the way in which policies differentiated them. But the water rights adjudication pits off senior claims against all junior claims. So this, it pits off the claims of the Pueblos, first of all, against the acequias, and then all successive junior claims, which may involve towns, cities, individual water rights owners who came later, or as well as water and sanitation districts. So there's this enormous legal mechanism that pits their interests off against each other. And in some cases, people have struggled mightily to have their water-sharing practices understood and acknowledged legally, because the way in which water was shared in the acequia communities and between acequia communities and their Pueblo neighbors was never a prior first in right, first in time, first in right, which in times of scarcity can translate into a zero-sum game, which is what's so dangerous, which means if you happen to own the most senior water rights and there's a time there's only, you know, 40 drops of water and you own the senior water rights, you get all 40. And some others will go without. That was never the way in which water was shared traditionally in New Mexico, because we couldn't have survived that way. Abundance was shared and scarcity was shared, which isn't to say that there haven't always been water pigs and there haven't always been people who fought over water and killed each other over water, but the way it's supposed to work is that you share the water. And if you look at the water sharing, the repartimiento de agua systems in the individual water-holding communities, it's always a way in which the water's divided and how it's shared in times of abundance, in times of regular flow, and in times of scarcity. It's never been a zero-sum game. So this is another way that's very important right now in how policy and legal process pits Indians off against Spanish-speaking peoples.
And that was actually my next question. It was about you know, talking about our, you know, sharing versus the adjudication and the speculation that's happening right now. And I don't know if, you know, just as far as speculation, I don't know if you want to add anything else.
Well, the water rights adjudication process is the local front in the global water war. The global water war means really the privatization of water all over the world. I think in most places, since no one can live without water, since there can be no life without water, without necessarily thinking of it as such, people have regarded water as pretty much a right, a human right, or God-given right, might be one way that they thought about it. Water is now being turned into a commodity, much as land was turned into a commodity. The water rights adjudication is a step in rationalizing the system so that every drop of water can be quantified, and according to its rank in the seniority system, its value is attached. So the most valuable water rights are the oldest water rights. So it's a way of rationalizing the system, quantifying it, to basically market all of the water in a world where the market, the buying and selling of water rights and the acquisition of water rights to enable growth is taking place. So the scramble for water rights and ways to get water rights is just going to intensify. And the adjudication is the first step. Well, maybe not the first step, but it's a key step in that process. Every drop of water will have a dollar value attached to it. And as you hear, and I'm sure you've heard this, as people say, water runs uphill toward money, which is what makes the water rights adjudications so critical. You can see how people's sense of place, sense of identity, sense of who they are is tied up with their connection to their land, to their place, and to their water. So opening a tap and having the water come out of the faucet involves a very different attitude towards water and where it comes from and what it means than when you have to haul it out of a hand-dug well, or when you're a parsianthe on a system where it's this whole system of sharing and allocation and deliberation and conciliation over water disputes is part of the local tradition. So we're seeing the globalization, you know, the privatization of water is happening everywhere, and everywhere it takes a slightly different face. But one of the grand facts of a globalizing world is really how do local communities, often place-based, often land-based communities, cope with these massive forces of privatization of vital resources?
Then some the last three questions that I had were if you could talk a little bit about language and vergüenza y respeto. And I guess, you know, I'd looked at your, read your book, and it was just kind of, it seemed to explain part of culture. I mean, just, you know, if that's clear.
Well, let me start with the custom. There's an old custom in New Mexico that most Spanish-speaking peoples, but as well as Pueblo peoples, as well as some peoples on the border, are familiar with. And you don't see it so much anymore, though people of my generation are familiar with it. It's not as widely practiced as it used to be, except under certain circumstances, that an elder asks a younger person, a child, for a glass of water, hijo or hija, tráeme agua. And the young person's supposed to drop whatever they're doing and go and fetch a glass of water, hand it to the elder, and stand there politely and respectfully, arms folded, while the elder drinks the water, however long they may take, and then hands it back to the youth and then blesses her or him. In my book, I take this as a really significant custom because what it shows, first of all, is sort of the old traditional ideal of how children should be raised, which is kind of authoritarian and rigid and involves certainly deferring to your elders. But it's this core value of respeto, which I think is throughout the Latin world, throughout, and as well as much of the Mediterranean world. It's a version of the honor-shame system that comes out of the Mediterranean, circum-Mediterranean, among both Christian as well as Muslim groups. But this custom shows, first of all, the proper comportment between juniors and elders. But the fact that it also involves water, I think, shows that there is a kind of reverence for water that's connected to respect between generations. And the whole idea of respect, or respeto, Respeto involves a whole complex of values that doesn't necessarily just translate so well into the English respect. It's a way of treating people that involves relations between generations, relations between the genders, relations between neighbors, relations between kin of different kinds. That is a way of acting honorably. And there are all kinds of ways in which honor is defined. And I think historically this is tied up very much with sort of the honor-shame system is tied up with the subordination of women and the sequestering of women and the value of women, of female chastity, and the notion that men must protect this and vie for it and compete with it, but women themselves are the vessels of purity. And I think a lot of the, certainly you see this in traditional Mexico, you see it in northern New Mexico, you see it in other parts of the world, but there's a whole ethic, it seems to me, that underlies this value system that I believe ties into the moral economy of water, as I've talked about in my book, is that what underlies the principle that water must always be shared. You mustn't hoard it to the extent that someone else goes without, because, of course, no one would survive if you did this, ultimately, in an arid environment. But that there is an ethic, that the ethic of sharing water reaches into other aspects of social relations. And the principle of treating people with proper respect is part of that. It's part of this whole cultural fabric. So respeto then is, I sometimes tell my students that if you want to grasp how to get along in Latin society, you have to understand what respeto is. And if you grasp what respect is in their terms and you behave accordingly, you'll get by. You'll get by okay. I once had a student who had, I thought, a really important insight. She was a Mexican-American student who had gotten an argument with her mother about respect. There was this generational difference. The young woman had grown up in a city. The mother was more traditional. And the young girl, who was very American in her orientation, said that respect was something that you earned as an American. And her mother insisted that respect is something that you owe as a proper person. And I think there's that's a subtle difference there, is that a person deserves respect. And a person gets as much respect, of course, as they give someone else. And it ties, I mean, with all kinds of, I think, sexual politics that I don't necessarily agree with, but that, you know, it has all kinds of implications for male-female relations that we don't have to go into right now.
And vergüenza?
I think vergüenza is shame. I mean, the honor-shame. The absence of respeto is vergüenza. But it's also having a sense of vergüenza. It's sort of an internal... Vergüenza means shame. There's a... In Spanish, people say that someone is sin vergüenza, which means that they're shameless. To be shameless is to be without honor, is to show no respect. If you show respect to people, you yourself will receive respect. If you behave in ways that do not show respect, that are shameless, then your honor is stained. So internalizing a sense of vergüenza means that you know what... I mean, there are certain things that you would be ashamed to do. To be shameless is to not be ashamed of doing anything, which is there to violate the code of honor or the code of respeto. And very often I see that this is often part of the dynamic when there's cultural conflict. And often cultural conflict is underlain by economic and political power inequity, right? But cultural conflict, what I mean is that how people comport themselves in a social situation. And I often see that people from urban Anglo-America have a very different set of norms than traditional, more rural northern New Mexicans, whether they be Spanish-speaking or Pueblo Indian. And it may well be other Indian groups as well, but there is a kind of reticence, a kind of reserve that is seen as an expression of respeto within these groups that is often perceived as passivity and lack of initiative on the part of urban Anglo-American people who come here. And there's a certain way of taking charge and of talking a lot and of showing initiative, of being a leader, of being an instigator, of kind of being an executive type that is integral to sort of how you get ahead and make your name in mainstream American society, that is seen as sinvergüenza by Mexican people. And just how somebody acts in a public setting or in a meeting, who talks too much, who doesn't talk at all, how decisions are made, who takes charge to show these people how they should do things. That's part of what's operating sometimes, is that there's a really different set of norms that are operating. And so people are reading these cues quite differently. And so very often, what's seen as someone with leadership qualities and initiative and take charge assertiveness is simply seen as being sin vergüenza and quite without couth.
And is it okay if I...